you just say what you care that you think you're prepared to share, but a little bit about your family background and whether, you know, was your family in CND, or did they, you know, were they encouraging or censorious? You know, were you from a military family? A little bit about your background and the politics that you grew up with.
My background when I was a child, you mean, was very, very difficult and very poor, very poverty stricken, which it shouldn't have been, because my father was a jazz musician and who played with Johnny Dankworth Band, which obviously in the 50s was very famous. But he was an alcoholic, and I later learned he took various things like heroin. So he wasn't there most of the time. And when he was there, he was very violent. And I got married and had my first child at 20. And by the time of Greenham, I'd been in CND for quite a while. I can't remember how long. And been involved in, I was helping a friend organise gigs to make money for Salisbury CND. And I learnt to screen print posters. And when I heard about Greenham, I was living right out in the countryside in Dorset, being a housewife. I was fairly bored, really. And I decided to, I drew a card of a woman with the world in her belly. And I took it to the art centre and we produced it as a card. And it was a few weeks into Greenham, and I decided to take it there. I was selling it to make money for Greenham, so I decided to take the money there and the card to show the women. But I had been involved in Greenham, in CND for quite a long time. And also in green stuff. I went to the Green Party. Well, it was the Ecology Party summer gatherings and then the Green Party gatherings. So I took the card. The women had been there for a few weeks in the autumn of 1981. And they really liked it. And it ended up on loads of posters and banners of the woman, even in Japan.
I think I remember it. Was it, as a poster, was it a black and white poster rather than a colour one?
Poster was designed by a man called David something from London, who was involved with the Quakers. But the woman with the world in her belly, he put on it. Yeah. Originally, she had a blue dress on, so that the sea merged with her dress. The sea of the world merged with her dress, and it was a long dress.
So that was that the first time you went to Greenham, when you went up in the right at the beginning with your
It was a few weeks in, so it was kind of fairly established with caravans and teepees and things at Greengate, what later became Greengate. And first of all, I lived in a teepee with another woman, and it became absolutely freezing. That was the winter that was the Arctic winter, the Siberian winter, and it was one of the coldest winters I've ever known. And this teepee hadn't had its poles rubbed down properly. So the water would, from melting snow, etc., would run down the poles and drip on you in the night. I remember my husband coming to visit me, and he managed about one night. It was too cold for him. I think women are hardier in that way. We can put up with colder weather.
I'm just thinking of all the sort of First World War soldiers that were in the trenches, because I think they had it pretty hard.
They did. Yeah, at least we weren't being bombed and shot at.
not quite. But that's, I mean, it's actually an interesting comparison, isn't it, about men leaving home to fight war and women.
That's true.
To fight wars and women leaving home and to, you know, fight against war. So so it was a particularly Greengate that you were stayed at.
Yeah, we were at Maingate, and Fran put her teepee up at Greengate. Yeah. So she could talk to the people who were constructing things on site. And I was at Maingate first of all, and later on I moved into a caravan. We did have some interaction with the base. There was one lady there called Marion, who was completely accident prone and absolutely wonderful. And she was writing a thesis on chaos at the time, chaos theory. And she lived in a tent which had a paraffin heater. And for some reason, she had gas canisters in it as well. And her thesis. And I remember one night I was sitting in one of the teepees, and somebody ran in and said, "Marion's tent's on fire." I was actually sitting in the teepee that the men were in talking to them, and we grabbed the water container and it was solid ice. So me and them and Fran ran towards the fire, and somebody shouted at us from the base, "Be careful." And we realised they were right as the gas canisters exploded.
Wow.
We hit the deck and the fire engine came out of the base. And one of the soldiers said to Fran, "That's dangerous stuff you're messing with." And she said, "Not half as dangerous as the stuff you're messing with." Anyway, we had to put Marion into a caravan. And she she had to go to a bar mitzvah one night. So I thought, when she'd gone, I thought, I'll go and check on the caravan because I know what she's like. And the bedclothes had fallen on top of a paraffin heater that was still on.
So she set the caravan on fire as well as her own
We managed to save that. Then she spilled a kettle of boiling water on her foot and had to have that the dressings changed a lot, big bandages and things. And one day we were sitting around the fire with her, and she said, "It's a myth that I'm accident prone," and put her feet out to warm herself, and the bandage caught fire. It was a really funny place to live a lot of the time. Despite the freezing coldness of waking up in your caravan and finding that even the eggs and the baked beans in the tin were frozen.
So what was happening to your children when you were there?
My husband was looking after them. I used to go back for a week or two and then come back to Greenham and kind of commute. I used to hitchhike backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
I can't say it did very much for our relationship.
Is it the same husband you've got now?
No.
That's so often the story with these Greenham women interviews.
He encouraged me to go in the beginning, but then I started to get told off, really, for not being there where I should be, looking after the children and everything.
Mm. So did you, so I was going to say, did you have a preference with the gates that you were staying, but really there was only Yellow Gate, main gate to start with, wasn't there?
And then there was Green Gate, which Fran was mostly on. We, first of all, when I went, I was very naive, and I used to be put to talk to press and all sorts of people. And then I wasn't, because they didn't agree with what I said. There was a lady who was writing a letter from Greenham, and she said that we wanted to tell the women of the world that we want peace. I said, well, actually, no, we don't. We want to tell the people of the world, because it's generally not the women that are making the problems. Mm. Anyway, she altered the letter and then came yelling and shouting at me and telling me that I could, you know, I wasn't welcome there. Anyway, so there was a bit of a rebellion going on, and see, this seems to follow me about this, you know, being rebellious and not agreeing with people. Anyway, I was living in a caravan with my friend Caroline. And she was organising the Embrace the Base thing, where we had festivals at each gate. And I remember we drove down to Leicester to get the marquees, and she was booking different things to happen. And Helen came into our caravan. One time we organised a load of men to come and do bridges over the streams and things, because there were a lot of streams and bogs all around the base. So they came to do that, and Helen didn't like that. So one day we were in the caravan, just sitting there, and she came in and said to Caroline, you're no longer a signatory to the bank account. Which was a bit of a shock, because Caroline was organising the whole Embrace the Base thing and the blockade and everything. So we had all these festivals at each, cut things at each gate, and we were going to blockade the whole base. And so Embrace the Base was actually later. That was a blockade we were doing. And we had no money.
Mm.
So she had to ring round the peace movement, basically. And people like Bruce Kent, and that gave her money, because we had no access to the money for the organising. And I remember we drove up to Leicester to get the marquees. Us and some other women were digging toilets. We got some long drops from Glastonbury, from Michael Eavis. Yeah, so basically it was us rebellious women that organised it. Mm. And I went to Greengate, and I would chain myself up to Greengate with some of my friends, and we were chained up for 24 hours, and that was the same all around the base.
Well, I was going to say, how was planning and decision making done? But
It was supposedly by consensus, but in reality, it was the tyranny of structurelessness, where the strongest and most bullying would win the day if you weren't careful.
Okay. So did you get arrested? Did you go to prison?
No, not when I was at Greenham. When I left Greenham in March or April 1982, so I was just there really over the winter and for the spring, and we started another peace camp at Burfield. And we were sleeping in those plastic orange bivy bags, first of all, outside Burfield. And I got arrested at Upper Hayford when we went to do the blockade there, the first blockade. And that was, I can't remember when that was. I got in the autumn of 82, I got a job working for Dorset Peace Council, and I was paid by the Quaker Peace and Service. And I trained two different NVDA groups, and people knew that we were basically, we just had a lot of fun and we giggled a lot. And so they put us on the gate where they knew that the arrests were likely to happen. And the police must have known that I had trained both the groups, because both the groups were put on that gate. And I was the only one arrested, first of all. And I was held by the scruff of my neck up in front of all the others, like an example, and taken away and put for an hour or two in one of those, is it a paddy wagon? Is it a paddy wagon? They're all metal, like little boxes. And you've got a tiny, tiny little window.
Yeah, like a horse box.
Yeah, I was in there for about an hour or two before they filled it up with other people and then took it to the police station.
Would you like to explain the connection with Burfield and Upper Hayford? They were both military bases. Well,
Burfield took apart warheads, basically, from cruise missiles and such, and I think it does Trident as well. They took them apart, and the stuff inside, I think, came from Aldermaston. So there was like a triangle. And then I think they put them back together again at Burfield and sent them off, because I know that the land-based cruise missiles used to go there. And that's why we were at Burfield. There wasn't at that point any peace camp at Aldermaston. It wasn't as secure at Burfield as it is now.
Yeah. Have you been going back to Burfield then?
No, I haven't been for years. But I think now it's a lot more secure from what I've heard, because I remember my friend Betty hitchhiked back to Burfield Peace Camp and stayed in the lorry and got right inside the perimeter fence on the lorry before they took her off and searched her.
So, yeah. So you came and went from Dorset. So were you part of CND in... that was the local, your local, because you were doing a bit of Green and Women Everywhere back home as well.
It wasn't until I'd left Greenham that I was working for Dorset Peace Council.
Oh yeah.
And I had to coordinate all the peace groups and all the green groups in Dorset and do a newsletter and do NVDA training, and I also organised the Star March. Do you remember the Star Marches? I organised the one from Dorset to Greenham.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. And I went on a march. I don't know whether it was one of the star marches, but it started off in Plymouth. And I was living near Totnes for the first couple of years of Greenham. I was coming and going like you. But there was a march that went all through the West Country and ended up at Greenham.
We might have met up with you because at one point, of course, we went through Andover and loads of marches went through Andover.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember the Somerset ones mainly. And that because there were quite a few marches, weren't there? There was the Snowball, that was a CND thing, the Snowball marches as well. They all came later.
I can't remember what year was it, the Star Marches? I think it was 83.
Oh, right. Yeah, that would figure with my timeline. Yeah. And stayed in all different church halls and peace groups and things, yeah.
That's it. And a bit of camping and...
Yeah.
It was good fun.
Yeah, it was. It was. So have you got any favourite memories and the worst memories? You've already talked about the freezingness and the fires.
I remember there was constant TV cameras all the time. And sometimes, you know, you'd see there was a lady from Germany who came back. And, of course, I ran to give her a hug. And there was this blooming TV camera that said, could you do that again? We said, no. It could be quite intrusive. There's all sorts of things happened. Like I had a friend called Fiona who had various pets, one of which was a hedgehog. And so she came to see us and she took off her Wellingtons and left them in the kitchen of the caravan and left her hedgehog out there as well. And it crawled into her welly. And then it couldn't back out because of its prickles.
Oh, yeah.
And we had to destroy her welly to rescue. Yes.
All those little things.
I remember the after the thing that we did with the blockade and everything for 24 hours. I mean, we were absolutely exhausted, and these blokes that had been looking after everybody, we just went to bed. They went out and got us dinner. Then a load of ruffians came along and started throwing stones in the middle of the night at the camp, a load of yobbos, and these blokes were then asked to sit up all night and protect us. So this is kind of one of the reasons I had a different attitude, was because these blokes stayed up for 36, 48 hours looking after us. What else? The other thing I remember when I was at Burfield, over Hiroshima Day, we did a fast in the centre of Reading and we slept in our bivy bags on a traffic island. And I remember I went to sleep and in the morning I woke up, I was absolutely soaked right to the skin, everything I wore. But what had happened while I was asleep was some of my friends had been beaten up by skinheads. And I felt terribly ashamed because I hadn't woken up, I hadn't heard it or anything. Yeah.
I was going to ask you if what was your experience of the reactions from the new breed locals and Reading, obviously.
They didn't like us. And I think it was quite a Tory area.
Mm.
We had a few people that lived nearby that were really lovely and really friendly. But no, it wasn't. We weren't terribly popular in the town, from what I remember. Well, when I was at Burfield, we had a few local supporters, quite a few in Reading, and some more locally in Burfield itself. There was an old couple, and they used to come and kidnap one of us and take us home for a bath and feed us and even darn our socks. And they seemed very lovely. They were kind of old communists.
Mm.
So I thought they were lovely until we went to a public meeting where it was somebody who was pro-Greenham and against a Tory in a kind of village hall political meeting. And we were sitting there, and as soon as the Tory spoke, he shouted, "Crap!" The old fella. And they just constantly shouted, insulted the Tory every time he spoke. We were sitting there thinking, this isn't the way to behave.
Yeah.
But they were very lovable.
Yeah. So you did quite a few sort of speaks going to, because of your role with the Dorset coordinator, you'd went and did quite a lot of talks and things at different groups, did you?
Well, I started off, the first time I had to speak to a big group was when I was at Greenham, and the local CND organised a really big meeting in Salisbury Arts Centre, which is a church, converted church. And I had to speak there, which I think I'd be absolutely terrified by now. But then I think I was just young and naive, so I just did it. I remember I got back to Salisbury. I couldn't get home to Dorset in time to get changed. So I had to wear a local Salisbury woman's clothes because I was just so incredibly dirty and muddy. But yeah, I did. Yeah, that was the first time I ever spoke in public. And when I worked for Dorset Peace Council, I had to do it a lot, particularly on things like the Star March, where when we got to places like Andover and that, they'd have organised something and they'd want people to speak.
Mm. So you did a fair amount.
My husband also, he was working for them as well, and he did organised the conferences in Dorset, and we had a magazine called The Radiator, which I don't know if you remember The Radiator.
No.
That was kind of southwestern magazine, peace movement magazine.
Oh, have you got copies of it?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Oh. Also, I've got pictures of, I've got the poster of the woman with the world in her belly. I haven't got any original cards, but I've got the see-through things that you use when you're making a poster on silk screen. I've still got the silk screens. I've still got some artwork I did for The Radiator, and I've got got the poster that I did for the Star March, the Dorset Star March, and another Greenham poster that was done for the Festival for Peace and the Blockade. So I did send photographs of them. I can't remember good. If it was to you lot or not.
There is a sort of archive of resistance that's being based in, I think, Bristol. I've seen them at the Green Gathering. They have a big exhibition space now. It's really great. That's a good place to deposit things as well.
So that, I mean, I didn't, after that, I didn't do much with the piece. I got arrested again, but I can't remember where it was. It was a base somewhere. I got arrested again and fined, and the Quakers paid my fine because by then I was a single parent and I couldn't go to prison and leave the children. I didn't really do masses. I went on all the marches and everything. I didn't, wasn't massively involved again in the peace movement really until the Iraq War, at which time myself and some other women decided to protest. I was living in Wales by then. We decided to protest in the Welsh Assembly. Mm-hmm. And we made T-shirts which each had a letter on, so that we spelt no war. And we went in with, obviously with our jackets and that on, and we went in, and at a certain point we got up, we took our coats off and got up on the chairs and spelt no war. But they had obviously sussed us, because we would grab really quickly from behind and marched out. And we'd organised it so that this woman who was a famous actress in Wales, she played the wife of Dylan Thomas. She was quite famous. She was supposed to be, when we got arrested, which we knew we would, she was supposed to be at the front to speak. But they arrested us the other way round, so that I was. So I was on every news programme in Wales saying that we didn't want the Iraq War.
Yeah.
And what was lovely was that Cynog Dafydd and, who was the other? The Plaid Cymru people came out and sang with us outside.
Because Wales was a nuclear-free zone at that time, wasn't it?
Plaid Cymru in the south were very anti-nuclear. I think they were a bit more pro-nuclear in the north with Anglesey and all that. Quite different in the north than the south.
Yeah. What did you make of the media coverage? I mean, you said that there were quite a lot of reporters and TV cameras and at camp, and it's quite opinion forming, wasn't it? The media coverage.
First of all, they kind of, it was quite shocking, some of the photographs, because some of the photographs, they'd kind of catch women in positions where they looked rather provocative. Which I didn't like.
What do you mean, sexually provocative?
Well, yeah, kind of chained up and kind of, I can't, that, yeah, it was a bit, it was fairly friendly, I thought, first of all. I think they kind of thought we were a load of weird eccentrics, and then it became more and more unfriendly. And we were kind of, you know, all the stuff about bobble hatted and everything, and
woolly hats, yeah. One of the things that a bit later on, possibly than when you were able to get up to camp, but there was a big split with Yellow Gate and the other gates, and I wondered if you had any comments about that. I mean, actually, you sort of summarised some of your experience around the hierarchy not hierarchy of oppression, but hierarchy of, I don't know, decision making and
Well, I mean, my experience of, you know, was that there were some people who, after the festival that we and blockade that we organised, they came out for the TV cameras and pretended to be clearing up and then went back again and everybody else did the clearing up. But you get that in every organisation.
Yeah.
We were aware of things that were going on when we were at Burfield and, you know, in the rest of the time. And while we were on the Star March. But I wasn't involved with it. I was more involved locally and training people for demos and blockades and things.
Yeah.
I kept well back because I felt a bit bruised by some of my experiences at Greenham. Mm. I think so now I see it from both sides a bit more now.
Do you feel that your involvement, what sort of impact do you think your involvement had on your life looking back?
A lot, huge amount. Gave me a lot more confidence. It destroyed my marriage, which wasn't too good, but it opened life up for me. And after I'd worked for Dorset Peace Council, when I moved back to Salisbury from Dorset, I worked for social services for adults with learning disabilities. And enjoyed that. And then after that, and I also worked in festival welfare at Glastonbury and various other festivals. And we started the Big Green Gathering.
Oh, yeah.
And we started the Big Green Gathering and that went on until 2007. 2009, we were going to have the other one, but the police stopped it because basically it was too popular.
Mm.
And too successful and making too much money. But that's what Greenham gave me, that confidence so that I could do the radio and things like that at festivals.
Yeah. Oh, great. So that was your personal impact. And what do you feel that what would you say was the Greenham legacy? We're coming up to the 40th anniversary this year. So on a broader scale, what do you see was the impact of Greenham?
Very much empowered women. Women saw that they could make a difference. It impacted Gorbachev.
Mm.
Mm. I mean, he actually cited the Greenham women as one of the reasons that, you know, for Glasnost.
Mm.
I think we had a huge impact. I think the peace movement grew hugely from Greenham. We were already large. If you remember that 1981 demo in London, that was huge then. And I think we influenced the next generations, our children. My son was on the huge anti-Iraq march in London as an adult. I mean, that was a million people. I think it was one of the biggest demos ever in the UK. So I think Greenham had a huge impact and made people realise how insane nuclear weapons are. We didn't stop them, unfortunately.
Mm.
But we got them. After a while, I mean, with Cruise Watch and that, we got them off those vehicles. They weren't going around the countryside threatening Russia, you know, after Cruise Watch and that. And that came from Greenham. Mm.
Yeah. At that time, Hi there. At that time, there was a huge sort of explosion, really, of peace camps all over the country. You know, like up women's ones and mixed ones. Now, I went up to Menwith a few times, Faslane a few times. It was a long way to Faslane. That hasn't ever really stopped in Scotland, has it? The
No.
British imposing the nuclear thing on submarines on Faslane. And I think it is definitely nowadays actually still part of the argument for a lot of Scots of having independence.
Yeah. Yeah, because they've got this base that they don't want. I wonder what will happen if independence happens, because I think it's far more likely now we've left the EU that Scotland would become independent. I wonder where they'll put them then. I suppose Plymouth, I don't know. Is it deep enough, Plymouth? I suppose it is. It's got submarines there.
Yeah. Well, they might get decommissioned.
That would be brilliant, wouldn't it? I mean, what use are they anyway? We can't use them without permission from the Americans. Mm. They go on about sovereignty, that we've got our sovereignty back. We haven't. We've got bases all over our country still.
Mm.
We have to ask the Americans for permission for everything.
Yeah.
I do rather despair of the young women nowadays, because I just think they don't remember what we did.
Mm.
And they don't remember why we did it.
Mm.
They don't seem to have the respect. You know, they seem to be pandering all the time.
I think it's partly because, as per usual, you know, a lot of women's struggles and achievements have been erased. You know, we're not even being recorded. You probably read or at least know this magazine.
I know about it.
Oh, right. Oh, okay. Well, I subscribe to it. So I've just had the new, they only comes out a couple of times a year. I always used to buy it at the Green Gathering, actually. And this issue, I got it this week in the post. So I'm just working my way through it. And there's, it's in the sort of news brief on the first few pages. It's called Twyford Rising. And it's partly a review and a promotion of a book. It starts off 28 years after the event of the Twyford bypass. You know, it's at Winchester. I mean, it's very much that our neck of the woods. And I went along to the Twyford thing for a few days out. But 28 years after the event, we have a book recounting the story of the direct action campaign against the M3 motorway cutting at Twyford Down. This was the first, listen to this, this was the first time environmental direct action on this scale had been taken up in the UK and inspired many similar campaigns in the UK and abroad.
Well, I mean, it's ludicrous to say there was no environmental protest, because they could say that Greenham was a peace protest, but there was all the women that were doing things, anti-nuclear stuff for nuclear power stations, trying to stop them being built. There was people like Brigg doing the Sizewell inquiry about Sizewell B.
Mm.
There was loads of environmental demos.
Yeah, and it was, and Greenham was so much about direct action. We probably didn't, but we really modernised the concept of lock-ons.
Yes.
You know. And also, for me, it was an environmental protest, because it's actually about reclaiming the common. For me, it wasn't just about nuclear weapons, nuclear war, America finger on the button. It was about reclaiming the common, you know. And I think, again, like what documentation there is in the mainstream, it reiterates that it was an anti-nuclear, anti-war thing. And for me, it wasn't just about that. It was very much about reclaiming common land. And if that isn't an environmental issue, I don't know what is.
Well, nuclear fallout's pretty much an environmental issue.
Is there anything else you want to add? I'm doing too much talking now. It's your turn.
No, you're not. It's good. Trying to think. There's so many things when you start thinking. That's the trouble.
Yeah. It's nice to just hear little antidotes, like the thing about your friend being accident prone and then she sets fire to her bandage on her foot when she's warming her, and the hedgehog in the Wellington.
And I remember at Burfield, we were looking for somewhere to camp. In the end, a farmer let us use a little area to camp in. But at one time we were looking for somewhere to camp and we thought we'd found a spot, and these men turned up with rifles.
Mm.
And they were kind of, I don't know what it's called, when they undo the rifle, put it back together again, and point it and things. They were just being very quiet and very threatening.
Yeah.
I remember that. I remember we made a cup of tea. And I remember another time at Boscombe Down, which, of course, they had the F-111s out. And when I was just finished working for Dorset Peace Council, and I went up to visit the peace camp that started at Boscombe. And we actually knew the mod plods fairly well because they were there all the time. And a busload of people that had been, they were a load of people that were to do with Stonehenge Festival, came along, tore the fence down and threw stones at the police. And we were not at all happy about this. And then the riot police came.
Mm.
So I said, I think I'll put the kettle on. So we put the there was all this mayhem. We put the kettle on. These blokes got back in their bus, and the riot police got back in their bus and chased these blokes in their bus. And I think they left one person behind, because I took a cup of tea over to the MOD policeman. He was obviously a bit shaken up.
Hmm.
And this bloke that had been left behind swore at me and said I was a traitor and that. And basically I told him to fuck off. You know, that he wasn't wanted there because we were non-violent and you don't throw stones at people just for their job.
Hmm.
You respect everybody. Even if you don't agree with them.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, yeah, it was interesting because we're both kind of in those worlds. There's kind of overlap between the travellers and festivals and peace movement. Mm. There has been right from the beginning.
So did you take your children to Greenham? Were they too little or too...
They visited a few times. But, of course, when I was there, it was in the winter. It was far too cold, really.
Yeah.
I went back to them. They visited Burfield as well, but I couldn't expect them to sleep in a plastic bag. They did visit. I don't know how good or bad it was for them. I think it was bad in some ways, because I think they really missed me. And yeah, that wasn't good for them. But they seem to be very resilient.
Yeah.
And actually, they are pretty anti-war and that.
Yeah.
As a result, I think I was too young, really, to have children. So I think I didn't think of them enough.
Mm.
I think I was desperate not to be a housewife.
Mm.
I think a lot of women that came to Greenham were like that. I think a lot of Greenham women were incredibly bored with how, I mean, how we'd been brought up to be.
Mm.
And we had to escape it.
Mm. Yeah.
Yes, I don't, these roles that we were pushed into and kind of conditioned to. I think that's another result of Greenham is that, and feminism is that we, you know, managed to a certain extent get out of those roles and become a lot stronger.
Mm.
So whatever's happening now, I don't know. I mean, what I don't like nowadays is the emphasis on looks and women being sex objects and, you know, people having, female singers on the telly having to be half naked all the bloody time in order to be famous.
Yeah.
You know, this is part of the thing we were fighting against, is being constantly seen as sex objects. Rather than as strong, intelligent human beings.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, we are sexual beings, but I don't know. The whole thing about appearance and makeup and all that kind of bollocks. I think that I very much, yeah. Anti it.
I was having a chat the other day with someone, and I was talking about Greenham, and I said, we were deconstructing the fashion industry.
Yes. The thing is, people started to copy us.
Yeah. We didn't have that terminology, but actually that was one of the things we were doing. We were quite... you know, chopping up clothes and painting on them and stitching banners on them and everything was definitely, we were an antithesis to the fashion industry that I think very much overlaps what you've just been talking about, the pressure on looks now.
I mean, a lot of it was to keep warm. I remember going to the charity shop in Newbury and getting I couldn't find ladies' long johns. I found these men's long johns, but also this strange garment which went like all in one and was like shorts and had a flap underneath so that you could go for a pee. So I wore both, and a woolly dress and trousers and leg warmers. And two pairs of socks. Yeah, we had to, I mean, it was really, really cold that winter. Really, really cold. But we were, I mean, we were lucky because at least we had teepees and caravans. When the eviction happened, women were reduced to kind of basically tarps and benders, weren't they?
Mm. Mm. Yeah.
I mean, what happened with you? Were you one of the tarp and bender lot, or
plastic? Well, I when there were sort of daily evictions, I started going up one weekend a month. I was working in Exeter Women's Centre, so I could get one week a month off and go and stay at Bluegate, and that was my, well, it was plastic sheeting. We just put a long piece on the railings every night and all bundled in together. I don't know when that was, like 85 probably. But then I got a truck because I just thought, I can't do this. I can't keep doing this. And also we didn't really have that many vehicles either. Women didn't own cars very much.
No.
I mean, there were sort of more middle-class women that had access to a car or something, but mostly we were really short of transport, weren't we?
I wouldn't like my daughter to do what I did, because I hitched backwards and forwards from Greenham on my own. I did have a couple of lucky escapes, but I really wouldn't want my daughter doing it. I did have a difficult situation with a lorry driver who was Irish, who stopped in a lay-by. But luckily, he noticed my wedding ring, and for some weird reason, maybe it was a Catholic, I don't know what, you know, and I told him about my children and everything. Yeah. And he desisted.
Yeah.
Escaped, basically. That did put me off.
Yeah.
And luckily, in cars, they didn't in those days have central locking systems either in cars, which was helpful.
Yeah. Yeah, you always knew you could open the door.
Yeah, you could get out at the traffic lights and that. Mm.
So you must have, did you have those conversations when you were hitching about, oh, I'm going to Greenham Common, you know, what do you think about the peace movement? Did you have those?
Occasionally. In fact, I did have conversations with army people.
Mm.
Because, of course, Salisbury was very much an army town.
Yeah.
I remember we camped outside the Guild Hall in the centre of Salisbury once, and we were sleeping on the steps, and all of a sudden there was this vast influx of soldiers, all drunk, who'd apparently been to a football match, and they wanted to kiss us goodnight, which wasn't terribly pleasant, but... We were just polite to them, and then the military police came. It was amazing. They saw the military police, and they were just like conditioned. They were, you know what I mean? They were instantly obedient. There was just one left asleep on a bench all night. It's very much to do with conditioning a lot of the army, I think. And I met army officer when I was hitching, and I talked to him about, and he said that he was anti-nuclear weapons. He said, I've been trained to go forward and take and occupy land.
Mm.
And you can't do that if it's radioactive.
Mm. Mm.
So that was very interesting. So there were people in the military that were anti-nuclear weapons as well.
Mm.
And I remember I went to visit with my first husband, went to visit Hayford.
Oh, yeah.
And we stayed the night, and in the middle of the night, we were sitting, I think it was in a dome or a bender, and somebody had chucked Molotov cocktail, paraffin things with a fuse at the camp. And we got up and went in the bender to be all together. And this American came along very drunk and came in with us and burst into tears. And he told us how he'd been at Woodstock. And how was he now hanging bombs on aeroplanes?
Yeah.
And that. And basically passed out and went to sleep. Then the police came. So we all sat in front of him,
mm-hmm.
people from the camp, so that the police wouldn't see him. And we told the police what had happened and that we suspected it was drunks to do with the base. And they were given the thing with the wicking and everything, and they went away. It's weird. We've also felt like we had to protect him, even though he was probably involved with some of the violence, because he was clearly really confused about what he was doing.
Yeah.
And that was the only way you could get a job or an education for some people, or health insurance for Americans.
Yeah.
I remember much earlier than that, in the 70s, we had a friend that was basically staying with us who was on the run from the army. He did get caught in the end and put in army prison, but he was on the run because he'd been recruited in Newcastle and very poor working class bloke. And he found himself in Northern Ireland and realised that he'd have to, you know, that somebody could be waiting to kill him as he walked down the road with his gun, and that he might have to kill them first. And he deserted. I think a lot of people, that they're recruited when they're very young and they don't really understand. They see things in films and that, with all these heroes and that. They don't really understand the reality of it till it hits them.